When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the School for Dumb Women, the podcast where we investigate the things you're too proud to admit you know nothing about. I'm your host woman, internationally wanted for tax fraud, Hannah Varrell. With me is internationally famous for that one viral video of her crapping herself at a fancy boat party, Alexandra Haddo.
I know you're jealous of my limelight, Hannah, but you'll just have to wipe that envy off your ass. Sorry, face.
And international dog competition winner, Caroline O'Donoghue.
I think they assumed I was some kind of Great Dane, and frankly, who am I to correct them?
As you may have guessed, today is a special episode in honour of International Women's Day, also known, by the way, as Alex Haddo's birthday.
I was there first.
So to mark the occasion, today we're going to be learning about why we can still tell what someone had for dinner 4,000 years ago, and how nits made you fail exams. Plus, Caroline will be talking us through an important lesson on how to stay alive during a hangover in your 30s.
So, Alex, you're here today to talk about daddies.
No, mummies.
Oh, well, that's less hot.
Yeah, much less hot. I'm talking about mummies, which it came about because I was talking to my friend Hubert, who is Austrian, and I was like, oh, what did you do last night? And he went, oh, I watched a documentary on the Habsburg dynasty. And I was like, who the fuck are they? And he was like, God, they really don't teach you anything at school, do they? Because he's not from here. And I was like, no, we just learn about the Tudors and the Egyptians on rotation for 14 years and then kind of have to do our own research after that. And then I thought, God, no wonder, like, it was definitely teachers writing the syllabus, though, because Egyptians are the most interesting.
They're the best ones.
For sure. I feel like we talked about the ancient Egyptians a little while ago. Caroline, you were saying they were your, like, favourite thing.
Yes, they were my main hobby.
Yes.
My hobby was Egypt.
They kind of feel magic, don't they? Because they kind of believed in the afterlife and there was all these gods, the sphinxes, the pyramids are spooky, guys, you know?
And the aesthetic.
The aesthetic. Very cool and camp. I love it.
And also, like, hieroglyphics. Like, graphic designers today absolutely shit themselves about hieroglyphics. It's like an entire pictorial language that, like obviously, like, there's, like, ancient languages that have pictures in them, but, like, oh my God, the hieroglyphics, just pictures, just a fish, a sideways walking guy, like, amazing. So good.
And that's how they knew. That was a bestseller, the fish and the sideways walking guy. So I thought, because I was talking to my friend Sash about this, and he was like, yeah, just do ancient Egypt for your section. And I was like, I don't know if I can cover the whole of it in 10 minutes. So I'm going to do mummies, because they are the spookiest bastards of them all. Let's be honest.
Yes, and there's a big spooky documentary on mummies that's doing the rounds on Netflix right now.
What is it?
I can't remember what it's called. So that's useless. But basically it's like, they found this new tomb in Egypt, like, quite recently, and it was like this race against time of them having to find something interesting enough for them to get funding. And if they didn't get, like, if they didn't complete the dig before Ramadan, it was all going to be fucked. But then they found this big weird animal, and oh God, it was so good. I really recommend it.
Oh, it sounds great.
If I could remember the name, I would recommend it.
Did you see that thing recently that kind of went viral where it was like a mummy and they said, oh, we've recreated what it might have sounded like. And it was like,
yeah, I feel like there was something lately as well where they found a tomb and were like, hey, we're just going to open up this tomb. And everyone was like, for fuck's sake, we don't need you to open up a cursed tomb right now.
Yeah, like, this is not the year for it.
This is not the year for cursed tomb openings.
Cursed tombs.
To circle back on that Netflix documentary, it's called Secrets of the Saqqara Tomb, and it's very good.
Oh, okay. So I'm not going to go through the very, very basics of mummification, because I think my point proven was that we all kind of learned that in school. They sucked your brain out through your nose.
Yeah.
Yeah. They kept the heart because they believed it was the sort of the essence of you as a person. So they never removed the heart. They took all your other organs out. Sometimes cleansed you out with wine, palm wine, it said.
Great.
We've been doing that for years.
Yes. And then embalmed you in loads of linens and sort of put lots of essential oils in between the layers to preserve you, and then they buried you. Sometimes your servants would have to be killed, by the way, to be buried with you so that they could go with you to the afterlife. So imagine being like, oh, the master's dead. Oh, God, that's my time up.
Off I go, yeah.
And pets. They found millions and millions of mummified pets from ancient Egyptian times. A lot of cats, because they bloody loved the things, but all different sorts of animals. So they basically mummified the shit out of absolutely everything. And interestingly, it's not just the pharaohs and, you know, people like that that got mummified. Almost everybody did, but obviously poor people couldn't afford to have it so sort of luxurious. So, like, as you went down the class system of ancient Egypt, basically the shitter your mummification was. Just like, wrap her in a bit of bog roll, she'll be fine. But interesting, what I did come across is that the ancient Egyptians are who you associate with mummification. But the oldest, there's mummification all over the world. But the oldest mummies were actually found in South America. In the, let me just pronounce this right. Oh, where have they gone? Come back to me. I think they were called the Chunchuro mummies. And they estimated that they were between 3,500 and 4,000 years BC.
So like 6,000 years old.
Yeah. And they were still preserved in mummy terms, like pretty well. There was also a Chinese lady that was found mummified, and they reckon she dates back from about 4,000 years ago. She was from a Chinese dynasty, and she is, I hope I'm pronouncing this right, Jin Zhui.
How do they know her name? Did they have a little notepad?
I think it's like what they're, I think they're like buried with details, essentially. And she was found in China. So various dynasties throughout China's history have been sort of discovered around the country and been mummified. Also, by the way, there's two types of mummification. There's one that's intentional, and there's one that's like you're just preserved because, you know, you died in the Ice Age in a cave.
I was going to say, I'm sure there's, because every so often they'll be like, oh, we found someone who's like 10,000 years old and they were just in a bulk somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. And like specifically, in fact, in the UK, the biggest sort of type of mummification were in these types of bogs where the chemicals within the bog, like, naturally preserved the bodies.
Oh, wow.
Awful. But yeah, so this Chinese lady, she was also known as Lady Di. She was discovered in the 1970s. She was wife of the Marquis of Di, blah, 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 during the Han Dynasty. But she was so well preserved that her last meal was still in her stomach.
Ooh.
What the fuck? How?
Was it a good one?
it was a bloody lovely dish. No, I don't. I actually don't. I don't. It doesn't say what the meal was, but they also don't know why she specifically was so well preserved. Mm. Also, what I found interesting was the word mummy derives from the Latin mummia, or the Arabic word mumia, which means an embalmed corpse, right? But then I was like, well, how can we call our mum's mummy, like when we're kids and stuff like that? Mm. And then one of the reasons I found the etymology of mum or mummy is the silent one. And I was like, oh, it's good old sexism at play.
Oh, lovely. What is a mother but a living corpse?
But I did it, and then I did some more research, and it's actually just because we say mother, so it's like a muh sound, and then it got shortened to mum. So don't worry, it's not actually as sexist as we thought.
Just a horrible coincidence.
Just a horrible coincidence.
A horrible and very fitting coincidence.
Yeah. Basically,
I have a question. Do we know when the last person to be mummified was mummified? Like, are people still being mummified these days? If not, when was the most recent mummification?
I think mummification is now kind of banned.
Yeah, because people do get like,
yeah, people get like frozen and stuff, right? And then, yeah.
Don't
so,
they?
Like, where does the definition of mummy mummification just become embalming? Because I actually know nothing about embalming.
Yeah, because what's cryogenics? Cryogenics is presumably, like, yeah, what makes cryogenics different from becoming a mummy?
In all my research today, I didn't hear of anybody being mummified AD after Ado Domini, whatever it is. So basically, I think Jesus must have barred it. no, but like
Jesus
everything
barred it.
Yeah, everything I'm not saying this is a fact. Everything I was reading about was always like thousands BC or like I think there was one maybe in the 15th century that I read about, but that was the only thing I read that was like even vaguely recent.
Yeah, but that was someone being like a cookie fruit, though. That wasn't like part of a movement, you know.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, exactly. So I think, I don't know, maybe as sort of religion modernized and stuff like that, they were like, we maybe shouldn't take out their organs and stuff.
But the thing is, it's like, it's one of those things, one of many things when you look at ancient societies where it feels much more advanced than we do. Because like,
yeah,
the fact that these animals and people are being excavated and you can tell, like I read about that Iceman in the Alps, and not only could they like have traces of his last meal, but also it was like, oh, clearly he was like shot with an arrow in the back of the leg, he wandered around for a few days and yeah, he went to a high place, and they could tell all this stuff, and that was just from ice. And so like with mummification, like formal mummification, they can tell so many more details about a person's life. And like if you think about modern society now, you walk yeah into a graveyard with the kind of knowledge that most of those bodies that are like over 100 years old have disintegrated to nothing, and that like under the ground it's just really boxes of clothes, and then like in another 100 years it'll be even more nothing again. And like, you know, we're actually not as good as leaving our mark on society than these ancient civilizations, except that we are destroying the planet, and that's our thing. We're doing
that's
that.
Our legacy.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I reckon if we don't even waste our bodies, we're going to do even more damage to climate change. It's going to be like, we don't have the space to embalm these bodies, okay? Let them go. Yeah. Let them be dust.
It'd be so amazing, though, the idea of being mummified and then being on a Netflix documentary in like 3,000 years, because the only things that will be left will be Netflix and Amazon.
Yes,
and then being true. Like, as we can see, she said she smoked socially, but actually had about 11 cigarettes a week. Regardless of whoever was around.
Yeah. The blue tinge here means she was a fan of Wicked in her liver. Do you want to hear some gross facts?
Yes, always.
About mummification. In the Middle Ages, Europeans would pay a high price for mummy flesh to treat their ailments. So like grave robbers would go to Egypt, raid tombs, and then come back, and then they'd fucking treat aches and pains with the deceased flesh of people from thousands of years before.
Oh, no.
What could go wrong? I feel like in the Middle Ages there must have been so many things that were caused by the bullshit they were doing. Do you know what I mean? Like, oh, just eat this poisoned dart, it'll probably take your headache away. Yeah, it will, because you'll start vomiting and forget about the headache.
I mean, you say that, but then you think of the amount of people who die not of cancer but of chemotherapy, and you're like, are we much better? Do you know what I mean?
Very true. Yeah, very true.
We have cures that kill people all the time. It just happens in a formal way.
Yeah, and that's the main thing that I always think of like, oh, what will we look back on and think, God, that was medieval. That my number one thing is always chemotherapy. Like,
yeah,
I think in the future we'll be like, what the fuck were we doing there?
As a disclaimer, I am very grateful for the chemotherapy that saved my sister's life. However...
Oh, we all are. We're just saying...
However, it is quite mad.
Yeah, we're just saying hopefully there's a nicer method in future.
A pill.
But,
a bam.
Yes, lovely.
A salve, maybe.
Yes, a salve. Pop the salve on, you're fine. But yeah, and the last thing I'll talk about, because I don't want to go on too long, is... I don't know if you remember being taught about this at school. The curse of Tutankhamun's tomb excavation.
Oh, of course. Tutankhamun was at the Bruce Springsteen of his day. Like, everyone knows that classic.
And I remember being fascinated by this because I was into, you know, magic and witches and stuff. And I was like, oh my God, it's totally real. Anyway, so I... And I couldn't help when I was reading this today thinking about the film The Mummy, where they all obviously die. But when you actually read the facts now as an adult, you're like, oh, okay. I mean, it was fine. So here's the... So it was Howard Carter and his team, okay, and they excavated Tutankhamun, the boy king. became very famous. Good lad, right? But the tomb was opened in November 1922. The only like slightly weird one is the fact that so people were saying there's a curse on this, and it was quite strange. And basically, at one point, Howard Carter went back to like the HQ of the dig, and a snake had eaten his pet, and the snake was the symbol of the king, and it was all very like. You know.
Also, the snake, a symbol of dry, arid landscapes.
Yes, there are lots of snakes. You know?
A snake, an opportunist to eat, yes. You know, a chihuahua that's come along.
Exactly. So they opened it in November. They sort of excavated it in, or opened, started opening, I should say, in November 1922. The financial backer of the entire thing, the 5th Earl of Carnarvon, George Herbert, he was present when the tomb was opened. He died 6 months later after a mosquito bite became infected.
So malaria. So again, the common disease of people who were exploring during that time.
Yeah, literally yeah. Every single thing that you read, you're like, oh, okay. Then 6 months, then like 2 months after that, a visitor to the tomb after it had been opened died after he developed a fever. And you're like, okay, well, again, fine. And then the rest of them, so like it's people that love this conspiracy theory, they're like, and then a member of the excavation team died from arsenic poisoning in 1928.
Like, we're all gonna die eventually, are they all part of the curse?
Yeah, really? And then Howard Carter's secretary died in 1929. She died in a bed of a Mayfair club, the victim of a suspected smothering. Ooh. So that's quite
that's quite mysterious.
Yeah. And then he died, like, over a decade later, and of, like, cancer, I think. And it goes, however, some have still attributed his death to the curse. And it's like, well, they've really stretched there. They've really decided what they want to believe and then gone.
I think what we've learned here is that people love curses.
Like, do you know what?
Is there anything more exciting than a curse?
Yeah. And also, I as I was reading it, I was like, oh, I wanted there to be a curse. It's much more exciting that way.
Well, the thing is, nothing you've said has proven that there wasn't a curse. Like, I thought you were going to say something like much more finite.
Well, quite, Caroline. But they all did, you know, they all did die untimely deaths. Let's put it that way. But then again, a lot of people did. Especially people who were travelling to Egypt in the 20s.
They died of being in the past and being adventurous, really.
Yeah, exactly. Of opening tombs of dead flesh. I think that would probably do something to your metabolism. Yeah. Not metabolism, you know what I mean? But also, I will leave you on the fact that Victorians... I mean, no wonder they were always bloody ill. Victorians held unwrapping parties known as mummy unrollings. So they would gather at the height of Egyptomania... and unwrap a dead body. What could go wrong?
Isn't that pretty much what what they do on that program Botched?
Oh God, yeah.
It's like someone will have a horrible surgery, and then they'll unwrap and be like, "Woo, I've got horrible new tits."
Yeah, yes, well, quite. What are the weird
horrible also, new tits?
It took like 2 months, by the way, to do the whole mummification process in Egypt.
That's a long time working on it.
I'd imagine
work.
You have several on the go, right? Like, I'd probably think, like, these are craftsmen, and I feel like we can all understand that the mentality of a craftsperson hasn't changed that much over the years, which is that, like, I can do one fully in 3 days, but I want to take on several at once, right? Yeah. So you have a huge workshop. You're like, oh, Mrs., it takes 2 weeks. Oh, we have to get a new part in from Germany. You know what I mean?
Exactly, yeah.
You know,
she'll be with you in 2 months, a shell of her former self. Wait, sorry. That was awful.
I remember I read an Agatha Christie book a couple of years ago. I think it was Crooked House. But there's this bit in it where they're talking about going to Egypt, and like the character is defending. He's like, no, I promise. I'm not one of those boring Egyptologists. I just, like, I'm going on business. I have to go. This is not, like, me being one of those people, like, those... Basically talking about Egyptologists as if the way that we talk about, like, gap year, like, privileged people. Like, it was, like, this really boring thing that rich people did to seem interesting and then went on about it for years. And I thought that was, like, the most interesting thing I'd ever heard about Egyptology, that it was, like, considered as such a pretentious thing in the Victorian age. Well, not Victorian age, or later.
I bet, because it was all the upper classes and stuff that could do it, I guess. Could go and fuck about.
Yeah, it's the ultimate rich kid fuck about holiday.
Yeah, it's the ultimate gap year.
It's like climbing Everest.
So there you go. Sod you, posh people. You deserve the curse. is what we're trying to say.
So, Hannah, today you're talking about a common childhood illness that plagued me through not one, but both Bush administrations.
And it might have been in your own Bush administration, actually, Caroline.
Never! I am not that kind of girl!
Yes, today I thought I would talk about the most international of international women, which is NITS. And I feel like we were kind of not sure if we'd actually done NITS before. We've definitely talked about NITS a lot of times. Mm-hmm. And we've done a segment on hair before. What's your relationship? Caroline, I feel like you have a very storied relationship with NITS.
A rich and storied relationship with NITS, yes. Yeah, I just had it a lot. And not like, which just sucks. I think NITS on International Women's Day is a great pick, because even though anyone can get NITS, girls do get NITS.
Yes.
Like, because girls, they have a lot of hair, they hang out in tight circles.
And they love secrets. They love telling each other like little
secrets. They love secrets. They love sleepovers. They love putting their heads places. Like, it's like an all-girls primary school is an absolute haven for lice.
Yeah. Oh, Alex, what's your relationship with NITS?
Oh, I remember. I remember when, you know, when someone had them at school and then you knew it was coming.
Yeah.
It was like, oh, so-and-so's got NITS. And then you're like, oh, for fuck's sake. And then it swept through the whole bloody place, no matter what you did. And I remember I had them once so badly that I put my hand into my roots in the shower and pulled out a NIT. And I could see it. And it was rank. And I always felt sorry for, like, you know, there was always somebody that sort of had it first, and then they were known as being like manky. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it was bloody horrible, because you knew you were gonna get it once, you know, by the time you knew somebody had it, somebody else already had it and you'd already played with them.
It was too late. Yeah.
Yeah, it was definitely our coronavirus, wasn't it? Like, we have been through this before.
Yeah. And it was the smell of the bloody NITS stuff, I reckon, would instantly transport me back to after the shower, having to have it combed through my hair.
Oh, it was.
Yeah.
I have such an array of sense memories about NITS, because there was the smell of the Lyclear stuff that would kill the NITS, but then there was the spray of the smell of the spray that was supposed to be a repellent that smelled kind of vaguely of like cherries. I don't know if you remember that.
No, I don't remember.
Oh, I don't think I had that.
I don't think it was effective, but I think my mum was just kind of trying anything at that point.
Yeah.
And like, there would also be this whole thing of like, you know, because the thing what also makes NITS so toxic around girl friendship groups is that girls love to exclude other girls. So it would be this sort of Scarlet Letter, Crucible style witch hunt of who had them and who didn't and who's getting alienated and who's not. It's awful stuff, top to bottom.
And whoever had them always had to be like, remember, they go for clean hair. They go for clean hair.
Oh, oh my God, the clean hair defense.
Yeah. But I don't know why you don't get them as much as adults. Or are you going to tell us that, Hannah? Because we still hang out in like clubs and stuff in a normal world.
Yeah, but I think the theory is that you need to have your hair next to someone else's hair that's got NITS for 30 seconds to allow time for the NIT to transfer. And I think if you're like at a club I don't think you have 30 seconds of like hair on hair contact.
Yeah, I see what you mean. So you can only get it by boning someone as an adult, basically.
Well, I suppose you could, yeah. I don't see why not. That I should say before we kind of get into this fully, I didn't realise head lice purists, like, you know, scientists, think that they say that the word NITS actually only refers to the empty louse egg. So they say like, oh, you've got NITS because you've got head lice.
Oh, okay.
Because the NITS are the egg. But I think that's stupid. I think call a NIT a NIT.
I do think NITS at this point in society, it's just like, it's an umbrella term for all things that live in your hair.
Yes. Although apparently that's more common. It's more common to call the head lice NITS in the UK. And in America, they'd call it like head lice.
Lack of creativity. We just like a bit of slang.
Yeah.
My head's getting itchy as you're.
I know, same. But the base of my skull is really itchy.
Should we all have
itchy?
A little pause to scratch? I have some NIT facts.
Mm-hmm. Go on.
Number one, obviously, they are international women. They're in, you know, I think they're in every country.
They're everywhere.
They're everywhere. They're not, because I always kind of wonder what's the difference between head lice and like lice on a sort of dog or something like that. But they are strictly human head lice. They only live on skulls.
Really?
Oh, what a horrible thing to say.
Skulls.
Yeah, they only live on, they're adapted to human heads. So you're not going to transfer them to your dog. Your dog's not going to transfer them to you. If your dog's giving you something, then it's like something different, probably.
Chlamydia.
Yeah. they have six legs and they have claws on the end of them to hold onto the hair strand. And they can't jump. I always assumed that they would like jump between your head and someone else's,
so
but they
do
actually
I.
crawl. They crawl along the hair, which is why it takes like 30 seconds for the for the transfer to happen.
Horrible.
Guess what they eat?
Skin.
Blood.
Blood, yes, Carolyn.
No. Yeah. Do they?
Yeah, what do you think they were doing in there?
I thought that was a tick, not a knit.
No. No. Why did you think they were in your head if they weren't sucking your blood?
I thought they just lived on your scalp and loved a bit of dry skin.
Oh. They could eat, I mean, I don't see why they couldn't eat the oils that come off of your scalp or something like that.
What, so did they cut into your head?
They have a little, like, yeah, sort of tubey thing that sucks up.
That's absolutely disgusting.
Blood. Absolutely horrible, yeah. I have some disgusting information on this from a website called Lice World, which I was thrilled to learn about.
Is
obviously.
A thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yes, when the head louse needs food, it moves around very close to the skin and checks it out until it finds a suitable vein. The head louse then pierces the skin with its mouth parts and adds saliva to the wound to prevent the blood from clotting while the head louse eats. The louse ingests the blood via two small pumps in its head.
Oh. I'm so glad I didn't know this information when I was 9, because I don't think my self-esteem would have ever recovered.
If I ever get them ever again, I'm going to freak the fuck out.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And they eat like several times a day. They're just always sort of like having a little snack, moving around.
And so where does the itching come from?
I guess from the little wounds on your scalp when they eat you.
Oh,
and
God.
Also they're moving about as well.
And they're moving around and sort of, yeah,
oh,
I guess so.
God. So dreadful.
So I thought that was disgusting. And also because they're quite like transparent knits. So you can see the blood like going down their gut, apparently.
That's the worst. I was Googling stuff like that this week because something bit me all over my hand and wrist. I mean, it was like horrible. And I was like, what the fuck is that? And I was Googling like what it could be. And there was loads of those little fuckers with like translucent bodies sucking blood. And I was like, things aren't okay. Who invented these? No. They're not needed. What's their function?
They're not needed. Yeah. You wonder if there is a god because head lice exist.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, there is a god and he's punishing us.
Yeah. I feel honestly, very much like head lice are the pigeons of the insect world.
Yeah.
Pointless. Everybody hates them. Get rid.
But at least with, at least with pigeons, you can train them to send messages long distance, whereas like you can't like pin a note to a lice and then have it hop across like 4 8-year-old girls.
That's true. Just to tell Stacey that she's not in the friendship group anymore.
What I'd like to know is what gives knits the inclination to move? Like why do they go from head to head? Why wouldn't they just stick with one?
I don't know, actually. I guess it's almost like, I mean, this is completely me guessing. I don't know. But I would assume it's the kind of opportunistic thing, right? That they'd be like, oh, well, I've already got friends and lots of family on this head. Let's see what that one's all about. Apparently, it's most often males that move across onto a new head.
Of course it bloody is.
Yeah.
Women stay and create the communities and create the artwork and nurture the young and come up with lovely folk dances and men just fucking...
lovely club activities for the children.
Men just have the telescope out looking for the next 7-year-old head.
Yes.
Going, land ho! And then they just move on, leaving those poor women to raise the children.
Yeah. Oh, actually, I do have some information here. Men, because the male lice are very sort of like interested in mating, I guess that's also another reason why they might be like, oh, there's another head there. Maybe there's a woman head louse on it.
Yes.
Off
right.
I go.
I was just about to say the women stay behind and just knit. And I didn't even realise the pun.
Yeah. That's very good.
Didn't even realise that's the greatest joke I've ever made. Yeah. I'm retiring. Good night.
in different countries, different regions, apparently, headlines are slightly different colours. Like if the headlouse lives in an area where people like tend to have blonde hair, they might be paler to kind of blend in better. And if they live in an area where people have very dark hair, they might be darker. Isn't that cool?
That's horrible.
Yeah. And they don't do wet shits. They only do dry shits. I don't know. Of course they poo. They have to.
Yeah. Not only is it sucking my blood, it's shitting on my head.
But it does wash out easily.
Yeah, no, I actually have a very strong memory of my mother going through the comb in my hair and finding a little kind of grey, greeny blob thing and her being like, oh, I guess that must be the poo. And it's honestly the worst thing I've ever heard in my entire life, I think. Oh, I'm so itchy now.
How do they bone? Do they bone or do they lay eggs and fertilise?
I don't know. No, they do. They do bone. Apparently mating takes a long time. It takes up to half an hour. And after mating, both the male and the female must participate actively to separate from each other. Should one of them die during the mating, they will be stuck together forever.
Oh my God.
This is also from Lice World, by the way, my favourite new website.
Imagine that, like, oh, this is Steve. We had a one-night stand, but he died, and now I just got to carry him around everywhere.
Yeah, how are you supposed to meet someone new with that kind of baggage?
I know. Where's your baggage? Attached. Yeah. You're never going to get your hole ever again.
No. My God. But I remember as well that the problem with lice as well is that obviously you kill them, but it's very hard to kill the eggs. So the eggs often hatch even after you've killed off the first generation, right? So you have to remove like all the eggs, which if you're like a little girl with extremely thick hair, very difficult to do because the eggs are white, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And they're stuck. The female releases a thing to like stick the egg to the hair.
Yeah. It's like, it's amazing that not every single person on earth doesn't have lice. They are such an evolved species. They've really thought of everything.
Yeah. 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 My next favourite fact, which I actually slightly misread, was a fact that I think we don't like to acknowledge about lots of animals, which is that actually, like, if they're not eating, shitting, having sex or laying eggs, they're quite inactive. They don't have a lot to do.
Oh.
And I was sort of thinking about animals. I'm like, especially things like cows and horses. I'm like, you literally just spend your day standing.
Yeah, how do you fill your time?
You're just standing there in a field, like, sometimes you eat what you're standing on, and sometimes you don't.
Can animals get bored?
Surely. Dogs definitely can't they, right, Caroline?
Yeah, dogs get super bored. Absolutely. But the weird thing about animals in general that we have any kind of relationship to is that every emotion that they have, we kind of invent for them.
Mm.
Like, I read this kind of recently where it's like, when you think when your dog is like sitting and watching you and she looks so adoringly, which she's doing right now, that adoringness I've invented, actually what she's doing is learning my behavior so she can know best how to manipulate me. You know, it's like,
you're living with a tiny evil genius.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So how does that relate to knits? Like,
how that relates to knits is that they are largely inactive. They just kind of like sit around on your hair all day. And they tend to sit on the hair facing the scalp, which I misread and was like, I thought they were facing the face and that they were kind of like along for the ride with you. And so you'd be walking and the knits would all be like facing forwards with you and be like, where are we going to go?
So it's like point of view stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, very, very like Ratatouille, except not one rat, but many, many lines.
Yeah, like Ratatouille or like Peep Show or something. Just kind of first person
Peep Show,
perspective.
But lice.
Yeah. Exactly. So I just enjoyed that at least you can kind of entertain your lice by going about your business and probably, you know, maybe it sees a really good head sometimes and it's like, come on, just a meter to the right and then we can, yeah. I just liked that idea. But actually, yeah, they're facing the scalp. So probably they're just looking at your scalp and they're not actually looking sort of outwards to the world. I don't know. I assume so. Yeah.
Not everything does.
They probably have horrible little eyes, don't they?
I bet they're sensory bastards.
Yeah.
Sensual.
My conclusion basically is coming back to the fact that they are headlines everywhere. They are international women.
As are mummies,
exactly. Yeah. And then I thought, hang on, if like, you know, I've been reading about how cases of pneumonia are down because of lockdown, because of COVID, that, you know, like all these kind of like side effects that lockdown is having on other illnesses. And then I was like, what are the headlice doing during lockdown? Like, how are they?
They surely must have. Oh, but kids are still in school.
Some kids are still in school. Yeah. Like key
but
kids.
But they're nowhere near as, you know,
close to each other
as they used to be, and they tend to be in like smaller select groups, right?
Yeah,
exactly. Yes. So, like, I know things are really, really bad for parents right now with having the kids home a lot and all that kind of stuff, but not having to comb them for nits as much must be a bloody miracle.
Yeah, must be pretty good. Yeah.
Only slightly related, just quickly, the flu has almost been eradicated this year.
Yeah,
and the only downside of it is that they don't have enough people to try and get a vaccine for next year because they can't get enough sample of the strain.
Oh no! Wow. So could we have another COVID, but with something else?
No. It's just it's nearly gone. Basically, the flu is nearly gone this year because it's hardly anyone's had it.
Well, maybe head lice are nearly gone. You know.
Yeah.
Endangered species.
That's maybe now is the time when we eradicate head lice forever.
Gosh, that would be amazing.
Yeah. There's been one actual scientific study about head lice and COVID. It was in Argentina, and they said that the prevalence of head lice decreased significantly from before. It was at 69.6%. I don't know what that percentage is of. It can't be that 69% of the population of the people that they looked at had head lice. That's, you don't have 70% prevalence of head lice, do you?
No, maybe have had it.
Maybe have, well, but then it's apparently it's 43% during lockdown. So I don't know what those numbers refer to exactly, but basically there's fewer head lice because of lockdown. Yeah. And I kind of like having thought about, you know, the, like the peep show head louse, kind of like looking out at the world with you. Yeah. I was kind of like, maybe that's sad. Maybe head lice could have been like our companions during COVID. Like maybe we want them to survive.
Yeah. You're not alone. Yeah, all those like mental health ads you see saying you're not alone is actually referring to your head lice. Yeah,
to your head lice. You're not alone. You're crawling with parasites.
And they care very much.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Okay, now it's time for our smart lesson. Each week we take a subject confronting modern femininity and pretend to have something useful to say on it. This week, Caroline, you're going to talk us through hangovers in your 30s.
Yes, Alex. You know, we've been talking a lot today about mummies and the sort of the physical visual evidence we see of an ancient civilization. And with that in mind, I'd like you both to take a look at me on the Zoom call today and tell me what you see.
I think you look radiant.
Yeah. You look like a happy gal.
And you're drinking a Diet Coke, so therefore you've got the blood of life running through you.
Yeah, I'm drinking a Diet Coke. Just out of shot, there is a plate covered in mayonnaise for where I once had a refried Domino's pizza that I had salvaged from last night. There's another pint glass of water out of shot. My hair is wet and in a bun. I am hungover.
if I was Poirot, I would be going through all of those clues and being like, she ingested a lot of alcohol last night.
She simply drank poison.
I always think that about going downstairs in the morning after you've been really pissed and you're like, so it seems I took my coat off here. And then I kept picking stuff up.
Evidence suggests. And yeah. Scurry through the fridge.
Yeah, evidence suggests I heated a pizza. Because you're like, what the fuck was I doing?
And it's always like, there always comes this vague moment where I, like, out of the corner of my eye, I think I have, like, a mouse or something. And then I realise it's just balled up tights at the foot of my stairs.
Or like, taking the tights off.
There always comes a point when I'm drunk where I just need to have as few physical restraints as possible. And I just like, I still want to be wearing clothes, but I can't be wearing a bra or tights or knickers.
Yes.
And so there's just like random bits just strewn around my home of like, oh, lovely. Here she is. But it got me thinking about sort of hangovers generally. And like, I feel very resentful about my age this year because I feel like I just turned 30 and now I'm about to turn 31. And I feel like that even though it's been a long, terrible year and we've all hated it and we all want it to end, I feel like this has come around way too quickly and I don't deserve it. How dare you? Like, I barely done anything fun this year. I should have a year's worth of fun experiences before I have to turn 31. And I'm really annoyed about it. But what I noticed as well is that the closer I get to 31, you know how like your first year in a new decade is basically a freebie? It's not, you're not really in your 30s yet.
Yeah.
I feel like as I'm coming closer to my first proper year as someone in their 30s, the fabled 30s hangover is starting to happen to me. Did you feel like they got worse when you hit 30?
I don't know, like mine, yes, on the whole have got worse, but I've still not reached the stage of like the world is ending hangovers. But I find mine are very sporadic. Like sometimes I get away and I think, ooh, scot-free. And then sometimes I have like 4 glasses of wine over the course of a whole evening and wake up feeling like I've been hit by a bus.
So yeah, it can be quite random, can't it? It's one of the few true randoms left. Hannah, you're slightly younger than both me and Alex. How are your hangovers at the moment?
I'm a sprightly 29, thank you very much. I mean, I don't think I've really had a proper hangover for a year because, like, who's, you know, I'm not getting smashed in my own house.
All right.
But
all right, Mrs. Morals.
just it's kind of like, oh, it's not so much fun. But I don't know. I definitely feel like some of the worst hangovers I had were actually before I knew what various levels of alcohol would do to me. And there was definitely a period in my 20s where I'd go out after work and not have anything to eat and then have 4 pints of beer, which is not like, an insane amount. But then I'd get home and be like, oh, I need to throw up now. I had this, a Pret salad at lunch at my desk and then 4 pints of Taddy's lager.
You're really calling back to a more joyful time, aren't you?
Yeah.
A lovely time of near starvation and cheap beer.
But I'm still waiting for the kind of like, I've definitely heard like apocryphal tales of the kind of the hangovers that make you think like everything is wrong with my life and like it needs to all stop right now.
Definitely. And like, I do feel like that the story of hangovers are like that diagram of the evolution of man, but in reverse. So it's like you start off in your teens like quite springy and resilient, and then the older you get you're just a sort of a anxious chimp curled over awaiting death. And I do and there is like a technical reason for this. It is because that your liver enzymes apparently diminish with age, so it takes you a longer time to metabolize alcohol. But that doesn't explain to me the like existential dread that I'm now feeling. Like it's very, I've shamed my ancestors. It's very thousand-yard stare into the horizon. And it's also, and I think this is very much a symptom of being a millennial person who spends time online and who's like a lot of careers online. But it's that thing of like, I have said something abhorrent and terrible. I've either said something or done something abhorrent that I don't know is bad yet, but it's going to come and get me.
My best mate gets this every weekend, and I'm like, I was with you. We were in a house, because she's in my bubble. And I was like, we were in a house, in a living room. Like, you haven't done anything.
Yet there is this lingering suspicion that you have indeed done something. It's awful. And, like, I thought, to get me over this hump, I thought I would remember all the humps that have come beforehand. Yeah. And I'm gonna take us through hangovers through various stages in our life.
Okay.
So, first of all, the earliest kind. Hangovers in your teens, which don't really exist because you sort of, like, you expel all of the alcohol the night before. Like, almost nothing sits. Mm. Because, like, I would say most of my nights, my proper drunk nights when I was, like, 16 up, I would probably vomit by the end of the night. And I would wake up, like, a daisy the next day.
I've never, ever been sick from booze.
But you don't really throw up at all, do you?
No, but I think that's part of it, because I don't want to throw up. I've heaved a lot, don't get me wrong. But I've never, like, actually full-on vommed.
Yeah. And then, like, I feel hangovers in your early 20s. It's like, that's when the sort of, you know, the pain, it's when, like, the headaches and the sort of, like, oh, God, what did we do last night thing ends. But I also think that hangovers in your early 20s are very, like, you trying to reclaim the sleepovers of your mid-teens.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's very just like you and two girls under a blanket watching Friends with a big thing of Fanta. It's just like, we've just taken us being 11, but now we're 21 and we just, like, are sort of looking after each other, you know?
Yeah. We still have that, my gang. We do that every weekend. Yeah. Not every weekend now, every weekend usually.
And it's nice. And then I feel like in your sort of mid-20s, to late 20s, you start doing more of the, because you have more money, you start doing more of the midweek work benders.
Yes.
And that, I think, is when it really starts to set in, like, big person
horrible
hangovers.
Mm. Yeah.
Where you go back into work the next day and you sort of feel like you're being pickled from the inside, like you're just this jar of vinegar with pickles floating in it, and the vinegar is coming out your eyes and out your ears and through your mouth, and you'll die if anyone touches you, and you're made of glass and you're going to shatter.
That's the thing, because the main tip really for hangovers is like, sleep it off. Like, if you get up at 10, you've slept through the worst part, whereas, like, the worst feeling in the world is getting properly weekend trashed accidentally in the week and then having to get up at 7:30 and get on a tube and go into the office. Yeah. Hell on earth.
And at least I think when you're a bit younger in the kind of a sort of a younger office culture, everyone else is kind of in the same boat as you.
Yeah.
Like, if you didn't get drunk with them last night, they got drunk with somebody else, and you're all kind of in that thing where you're like, oh, let's go out and take a long lunch, or let's all go to the place around the corner that does cheese toasties, or there's a kind of a community sensibility about it, isn't there?
Yeah, communal delirium.
Yeah, exactly. And then, like, generally by the time you're ready to go home, you can either have another pint, or you feel kind of fine, you know, or you're going to have, like, a nice soft night with an oven pizza and your housemate, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But now that I'm in this spot, the only thing that's good about it is that I can get Deliveroo with no worry that it will bankrupt me.
Yeah.
So that's nice. But the existential dread is hurting me. And also... and also, I found this thing has started to happen as well, where the option to sleep it off until noon has vanished, because it's like...
Yes.
My heart rate increases or something while I'm drunk and asleep, and I wake up just feeling, like, very panicked and, like, I'm about to have a heart attack and I have a disease.
Mm. Yeah, that heart beating thing is your body trying to get rid of the alcohol and pump it away through your system.
Oh, God, that's sad, isn't it?
It's so sad. Our poor little heart, she tries so hard.
Have a calming drink. Don't whatever you do, have a cup of coffee or tea or have a Diet Coke that early, because you'll go into what I call panic mode.
Ugh.
Panic station 101. Yeah, you have some squash, a big thing, a pint of squash.
Yeah, it's so lame. I think as well, I might be in the situation because I had been doing a lot of like steady sort of like glass of wine with dinner thing. like yeah. basically every night for about 3 weeks there. And me and Gavin kind of fight. We're like, oh, this is getting a bit bad. And both of us feel sort of anxious and sweaty all the time. Maybe we should just quit drinking for a week and see how we feel. And we did that and it was amazing. And we both woke up at 7:30 every day and we both felt better. And then that amazing feeling you get when you stop drinking for a while is also the perfect feeling to want to have a drink.
Yes.
Because you feel that, like really like, yeah, chatty and lively. Like, let's go for a walk around the neighborhood and have a beer kind of thing. And now let's walk three times around the neighborhood with this beer and sort of talk to people as we see them. And oh God, it's sunny and we're all full of life again. And maybe the disease will end.
Yeah.
And here I am.
Bloody optimism to sends us worse. That's the balance of life.
I do think that that is like a problem as well, isn't it? That like not drinking lots regularly lowers your threshold for how much drink affects you, and then you're like, okay, I'm gonna go out and have like, I don't know, like I can have half a bottle of wine and be like, this is terrible, whereas before I could do that without, you know, too much of a problem.
Yeah It is amazing. It is incredible that we choose to ingest this poison so frequently. My poor little heart just can't take it.
And also you have a dog, right? So like probably even if you didn't want to get up, she'd be like, hi Caroline. Hi.
Oh my God, she's been so patient today and I can tell she's so angry. Oh. She's literally at my leg right now because she hasn't been out yet, so we kind of have to wrap up.
I know, imagine being this hungover and then having a kid.
Oh God.
Saints, all of them.
Honestly.
Should we do some quick fire tips for hangovers in your 30s?
Yes.
Throw your phone away. Because the amount of times I've sent messages where I've been like, what? I didn't even mean that.
Yeah. And the thing of like, I really hate that hangover spot of like, you're on your phone in front of the TV and it like, it's just horrible and you're just scrolling and not paying attention to anything.
Yeah, the concentration levels have gone the next day.
I think the only thing that's made today nice is that I had my phone in another room and I was reading like the collected A.A. Gill, which is just fun. And it's like, oh, this is like reading, but it's not like hard reading. And like, he's funny and he's obviously really good. And he wouldn't judge me for being drunk. Mm. So
yeah.
I think if you can find a book that is quite easy to read and quite friendly to you, you will generally feel better about yourself. Because at the very least, you read a book today.
Mm. That's
yes, a good one. Exactly. That's a good... And my other tip comes from Richard Spalding, I was going to say a friend of the show, but he's never been on. But we sort of know him. He always says, don't lie to yourself. Prepare for the hangover with a selection of drinks and the first thing you're going to want to eat in the morning in the house.
Mm.
So you don't have to go out to the shop and get it. So he always gets like a Ribena, a Diet Coke.
Yeah.
Ribena is a lifesaver for hangovers.
Yeah.
And then, having like, a selection of bevs is definitely something that makes you feel more in control.
A selection of bevs and like, you know, whatever you're going to want to eat for breakfast. And then you just feel like, okay, I've tackled that without having to do a dreaded like trip.
Ugh, the horrible like trip to the corner shop when you have to put like a coat over sweatpants and you've got no bra on and the misty rain in your face and like the guy gives you attitude about it. It's ugh.
And like people that the worst thing ever is when you've been on like a real bender and you basically you either haven't been to sleep or you've, you know, people you start seeing people get up for a jog or something and you're like, oh, I've passed into the bad place.
Ugh, it's so the bad place. I was actually really grateful this morning that the sky was just a horrible low white. So I was like, oh, no one can judge me for being inside during this. But now actually the lovely blue sky. So I think I'm going to go walk the dog and feel good about my life.
Well, that's all for this week. If you enjoyed listening to this episode, you can hear more by searching School for Dumb Women on your favourite podcast app and following us on the usual social media platforms at Dumb Women Pod. You can also hear us on Soho Radio on the Culture Channel. Thank you to Gavin Day for our artwork, Harry Harris for our jingles and Soho Radio Studios. Goodbye, good hangover.
Goodbye, mummies.
I'm a jar of pickles.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack
for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.